S-A-P-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shimma, shimma! Shimma, shimma! Shimma, shimma!
Let me in!
Shimma, shimma!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shimma, shimma!
Open up your soul!
Shimma, shimma!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And you know what? San Francisco is a very literary town. There are lots and lots of authors making great books. We had some authors on before who did Disasterama. We've had a lot of authors on. And we have a lot of librarians on. So when the two overlap and coincide, you know you're going to get something good. So I have, not in his capacity as librarianista, but in his capacity as a fabulous author, I'd like to welcome Mozam Sheikh. Hello.
Thank you, Marilyn, for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure to come back in whatever role I have been come to see you here, but today I'm here with my book.
Well, let's start with, like, when did you start writing?
I would say the late 80s.
Oh, wow. You know, that's a long time.
Yeah, or early 90s. I mean, start tinkering with, you know, reading also. And uh-huh. Just sort of like say, okay, you know, writing just small things, sharing with friends and getting the early encouragement.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly feeling okay, you know. If I don't tell my parents, maybe I can become a writer.
Oh, so your parents, like, because I would think that being an author would be respectable literary.
Yeah, I'm saying it in jestfully.
Got it.
You know, opting to become a writer sometimes just means, okay, so you won't have a real job, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the time when you could work in cafes and bookstores and mm-hmm. still pay your rent, but you can't do it today.
No, you really can't. You can't really work anywhere and still pay your rent. San Francisco, right. But that's another story.
Yeah.
What was the first book that you ever wrote that got published?
Yeah. So my first book of collections was called The Idle Lover and Other Stories, and it was published by a small press in San Francisco in 2010.
Okay. And did your parents see it?
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom did.
Okay.
My father had passed away, so
okay.
Yeah.
And was she, like, super proud? Like, oh.
Yeah. So, obviously. And my family, too. You know, I have a lot of cousins who live across USA. And even if they don't read, but they see the thing, okay, we have a cousin who writes.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. So you published your first book in 2010. How many books have you written since then?
Well, I have three books of fiction.
Okay.
And I've done translations as well.
Oh, interesting. From what language to what language?
Well, across Urdu, Punjabi, English, and even Hindi.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So I can do that.
That is very cool.
So I've translated from Urdu into Punjabi, Punjabi into Urdu, English into Punjabi into English. So that's why I said across languages.
Okay.
So.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, English, Urdu, Punjabi, and Hindi.
Okay. Yeah. That is very cool.
Yeah.
I speak one language well, English, and two languages poorly. So the fact that you're good enough to translate. I'm very impressed by that.
Thank you.
So, but we're here not to talk about your translation skills, but to talk about your writing skills, because you've written a new book. What's it called?
Well, it's called A Footbridge to Hell, Called Love.
And why is it called that?
Well, it's playing on certain notions, you know, love is the dog from hell, you know, all these ideas that have existed in the English language and the literary, you know, and you know, love is not an easy thing, whether it's a love for city, you know. So this book is part one of San Francisco Quartet. So I have four novellas, three are coming.
Oh, okay.
So in the process of writing, I realized, despite having a lot of characters, the main character was San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
So and that's why I said, okay, there's a thematic glue here. But as you know, especially being in San Francisco, loving San Francisco has not been an easy thing. San Francisco can be hell. San Francisco can be a paradise.
Yes.
And San Francisco can be a purgatory, limbo. You know, you just don't know when you're going to get evicted.
Yeah, or a dystopian landscape. You know?
Right. You know, and there are a lot of self perceptions that we live with in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't really tell if you're liberal, if you're progressive, you know, all of that. So that was at the back of my mind when these novellas started to come.
Okay.
Which are, you know, so they're very different from my short stories in a way. My short stories, you know, can be very overtly political, and they go to different places, like, you know, places I come from, India, Pakistan, and here, you know. But these novellas are very, very San Francisco and maybe a little bit Bay Area-centric.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier a quote that I had never heard of, which is, love is a dog from hell.
Yeah, it's either a short story by Bukowski or like a part of a poem, you know, or maybe a Mexican movie, which I can't recall. But, you know, but the idea that, you know, love is a dog from hell is out there.
But what does that mean?
Well, love can kill you. I mean, love is intense. It's not easy loving, you know, when, you know, no matter what age it is, you know, teenager love. I mean, if you see kids going crazy. Oh, he dumped me. I can't just go on and this and that.
Right. This is super drama.
Yeah. So the intensity of falling in love, you know.
Okay.
So
with this book, A Footbridge to Hell Called Love, what you mentioned that San Francisco is a character in it, but what's the arc of the story or the premise?
Well, it's the novella itself is modeled after a piece of music. So it has three parts.
Okay.
And between each part, there is an interregnum. There's time has lapsed.
Okay.
So it's not a straightforward narrative.
Okay.
The first part, too many characters. He's much younger. The main character was from Pakistan, very assimilated. Most of his friends are the literary type, the writerly type, into music or just hanging out, working in cafes. Mm-hmm. The kind of San Francisco I remember, the kind of San Francisco I lived in the 80s and early 90s before the tech world started to alter
the landscape.
The landscape, the milieu, you know. So second part is a few years later, he's a little bit more somber. A lot of friends have moved away to different parts of the country, as we all experience. But that was always happening in San Francisco.
Yes.
You know, the notion San Francisco being transient city for some people, as much as a refuge for a lot of people running away from different parts of the country and finding a safe haven, you know. And I saw that quite a bit. And it puzzled me, and it took me a while as an outsider. It's not easy to come to a new country and know the difference between Norman, Oklahoma, and San Francisco, California.
Yeah.
To an outsider, it may just look the same. You have to live here, and you have to live in the belly of the city also, you know?
But isn't that true wherever you go in the world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, but the size of the country matters. I mean, if you go to... You know, I don't know. I don't want to pigeonhole a country, but chances are each country has its own complexity, and you know. But the U.S. is huge, and with its racial history, and it's, you know, one of my complaints with my fellow writers is that when we write in America, if we don't have a correct perception of the kind of country we live in, do we live in a democracy? Do we live in a you know,
a hidden caste system?
Not just that, but you know, is it a faulty democracy or is it an empire? If that never even occurs to you, whether you're a black writer or a Latino writer or a white American or feminist writer, if that doesn't pass through your thinking process and you don't question that this little place that I work for, its sources of revenue are connected to our 130 bases overseas. So I'm not saying your novel actually has to tackle that.
Sure.
You know, that would be being overtly political.
Mm-hmm.
But that consciousness has to exist. You know, and I think that sort of problem exists in so many levels. And again, it's a much wider conversation that needs to happen maybe in larger talks. And, you know, but I write more and more so with that idea.
That the United States is an empire?
Yeah, you know, our taken for granted assumption that we're liberal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but on certain things we just, that's going too far. You know?
Well, let me ask you this. Since you say you came to America, where did you come from and where you came from, did you it sounds like you're going to say Pakistan.
Yeah.
Did you view America as an empire when you were in Pakistan or when you came here? And
well, in Pakistan, we viewed it as superpower.
Okay.
You know, our own educational system is also very, very weak in India and Pakistan.
Okay.
So we, despite having been colonized for 200 years or so, it's not taught to us. So the word colonization also doesn't exist in a normal lexicon unless you're very educated.
Okay.
But people are very sharp and sophisticated because the culture is very deep and sophisticated culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see through certain things, which I feel as if Americans are a little bit on the naive side. And there are complicated reasons for that. It's not that people here are not smart. They're very smart people.
Right.
And they have given so many great scholars to the world. You know, white writers, black writers that people all over the world read and learn, you know, such as James Baldwin and Edward Said and Noam Chomsky and Angela Davis. And the world is aware of them, you know, and we learn from them. But when you come here, you do acquire a new vocabulary because academia here is much stronger.
Okay.
It's available, you know, there's a discussion. I mean, like my first exposure to apartheid in South Africa, happened here. I saw people, UC Berkeley students marching. You know, this is like 1985.
I remember those.
You know,
yes.
But it was actually Pakistan and the rest of the world that refused to play cricket with South Africa, but we didn't know the word apartheid. Both are important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here in America, our, you know, good leader, Ron Dellums, and, you know, he'd been putting on the table, hey, we got to start, you know, do something of this part. And nobody would listen to him. It took him 17 years to get the ball rolling that, okay, you know, because it was a people's movement and the politicians became embarrassed, you know. But India led the movement and no, we're not going to play against an apartheid country, you know. But we didn't know the word apartheid in Pakistan. So the word racism, colonization, all those that do, that's part of my education, which started here through all kinds of friends. They were black, they were white, they were Latino, men, women, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindus, you know. So I really owe that to San Francisco, that political consciousness or literary consciousness. And it shows up in my writing. You know?
Now, you mentioned, you told us about the first, when he's younger, and then the time that's passed, and he's slightly older, and the third.
He's still not old, but he's settling down. Okay. You know, he reconnects with an older friend who is a very, you know, interesting and problematic character.
Mm-hmm.
And he has reached a point where you take the challenge, and you're not restless. You know, you're not looking for perfection. The perfection comes from within, that this is the person, I'm flawed, she's flawed, the city is flawed, the system is flawed. But within that flaw, there is something sublime. and that is love, and that is hell.
And so that, and that is a footbridge to hell called love, which you say is part of a four. It's going to be part of a four piece set. I want to make sure we cover everything before we run out of time.
Sure.
This four piece set. Explain, like, why is it divided into four?
Well, they're very different. So they're not the same characters.
Okay.
And all my characters, unlike my other writing, they are based on people I have lived with, loved, worked with, known. Some are dead, some are living.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them fall through the cracks. I've seen them survive, rise up. But they're all composites. They're not based on one single person. So they're all composites. So maybe my main character is a composite of six characters that I've known who are from India and Pakistan, and their values, their habits, I had to sort of like eventually in the process of writing. So they're not connected. They're different stories.
Okay,
but they're all taking place in San Francisco with those types of people, people I was close to, and I still am.
Now, where is the book available now?
Well, it's locally available. It's published by a very small press in San Francisco. So it's available at some of the bookstores, such as, you know, Green Arcade on Market and Goff. And I believe Medicine for Nightmares is carrying it. Our library has a lot of copies, you know. That is the problem with small presses, that they just don't have the reach where bookstores can start, you know.
Sure.
And I can get into it some of the time. You know, it's just... We live in a corporate culture, which affects even, you know, the
distribution of
everything.
Well, if people wanted to know more or wanted to be able to follow you and know more about what you do, do you have an online presence that they can go to?
Yeah, you know, if they just type my name, Moazzam Sheikh.
And you're going to need to spell that for our listening audience.
Yeah, Moazzam Sheikh. It's a very unusual name. And everything about me, my political alliances, and, you know, everything just is right there. I don't like hiding anything. If I'm vocal about certain political issue, it's out there, you know, either whether it's on Facebook or my blog or whatever, you know.
Okay. And you also said that A Footbridge to Hell Called Love is available at the San Francisco Public Library.
It is, absolutely.
Excellent.
And it's by... San Francisco is being read, you know. I'm very heartened to see that there's a couple of holes every day, you know. But it's by word of mouth, you know. It's just, and I really wanted to be that kind of a book, you know. No New York Times review books, and Chronicle won't touch it, you know. It's just my friends, people I know, and people they know. And I'm hoping if the book has any value, it'll reach.
Right. Well, with that, Moazzam Sheikh, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure, Marilyn. Thank you so much.
Okay, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to get the book A Footbridge to Hell Called Love. So you're going to want to go to your public library, pick that up, and, you know, just enjoy it. In a few moments, we're going to be speaking with someone about Shakespeare in Love. So do stay tuned.
That woman, man. I'd rather be that devil than one. Lord, I'd be that woman, man. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That's Maloyan Devil that we're listening to in the background. No devils here, though. Only people who will entertain you. For example, there is a lovely show happening called Shakespeare in Love. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome the director of the show, Nick Moore. Hello.
Hi there, Marilyn.
How's it going?
I'm doing just fine. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. But we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about Shakespeare in Love. Tell me about this show.
Wonderful. Yeah, Shakespeare in Love, the way I see it, is a love letter to William Shakespeare, to live theater, and to artists and dreamers everywhere. It is based on the Oscar-winning film by Mark Norman and Tom Stoppard, and it was adapted for the stage by Lee Hall in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, fun romp through Elizabethan England, tells the story of Shakespeare's inspiration for Romeo and Juliet. It's a romance, a fictional romance about William Shakespeare, as well as being this lovely look into the behind-the-scenes antics that go on in the labor of love that is creating theater.
So I probably have some listeners who maybe didn't see the original movie. I saw it way back when, but again, it is way back when. So can you give our listening audience a little bit of an understanding of the plot of Shakespeare in Love?
Lovely, yeah, of course. Shakespeare in Love is about a young William Shakespeare who has writer's block because he has no muse. So on a commission of the heart, he meets Viola de Lesseps, a young, wealthy mercantile woman in England, and he falls for her even though she is out of his class. And the two of them, much like Romeo and Juliet, woo each other in secret. Meanwhile, Viola dresses as a man to become an actor in Shakespeare's company.
Mm-hmm.
She is the spirit of freedom trying to be let out and wants to be an actor, even though that is at the time illegal on the public stage in England. So the comedy comes from Viola being unable to confess her love due to her cross-dressing as a man, as well as the antics between all the backstage theatricals. But at its core, it is this romantic story about a young William Shakespeare falling for a feisty, brilliant, beautiful woman who inspires his great heroine of Juliet.
And when you directed the play, like, were you already familiar with it, or was it something that you were like, oh, I haven't heard of this before?
No, I'd seen the movie like way back when, and I'd seen productions of the play before. It was something that I was really excited by, and I thought was really, really fun. I feel like it holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts. One, if you're anyone who appreciates Shakespeare and live theater, you will feel very like touched and seen by all the references and by all the it's very empathetic towards artists, which I think is beautiful. Along with that, I also felt like when seeing it, I think it tells a really beautiful story for young artists, young dreamers to listen to, or dreamers at any age, really. Anyone who's thinking of following their passion or following their dream, because it shows William Shakespeare, who's, you know, the highest literary figure of all time. It shows him as a flawed, you know, anxiety-ridden, writer's block, struggling man. And we get this, by giving us this empathetic view of Shakespeare, I think it can inspire everybody to think, you know, if I just keep following my heart and following my dreams, you know, one day I could write the greatest literature of all time. One day I could create the greatest art of all time. And I think that's a beautiful message to send anyone home with.
Not only that, but it also, when you put someone who is revered into, it humanizes him as someone who, just like you, has writer's block, and just like you, doubts himself, and just like you, has those bad days. So I love that. So tell me, well, first of all, you're directing this show. How long have you been working with the Novato Theater Company?
I've been with the Nevada Theater Company since I was 15 years old.
Wait, what? Elaborate.
The first play I ever did in my life was at the Nevada Theater Company, and I did a few more there, and then I, you know, went to L.A. and New York and did some theater out there, and now I'm back in the Bay Area and directing for the first time.
Oh, this is your
at the Nevada Theater.
This is your first time directing? That's great. So before you were on the actor side, now you're on the director side. Is there anything, now that you're a director, that you were like, you look back and you go, oh, man, I was way too hard on this person because directing is much harder than I thought?
I think I just gained a deeper respect for the amount of people power and the amount of patience and hard work that goes into being a director. And to making theater in general. I mean, actually, honestly, it's very serendipitous that this is the play I'm directing, because this play is all about the struggles of creating theater. And, you know, now for the first time in my life, I'm facing the struggles of creating theater. And so to see, like, you know, we watch an actor up on stage and we don't see, you know, the lighting designers and all the people who hung and focused the lighting and all the people who created the sound effects and all the people who built the set and painted the set and built the lobby and built the, you know, there's so many people who craft the whole experience, you know, from professionals, contractors to volunteers. Like it's such a labor of love, and it's also such a collaborative group effort. And I think bringing that to light and being able to see that experience for myself has made me very humbled, and also built this just deeper gratitude and respect for theater and for art.
I love that. So now you're directing, and you have actors to direct. So who occupies those roles in Shakespeare in Love?
Yeah. So we have two actors, Michael Gertz and Rachel Keneally. They are playing Shakespeare and Viola, the two lead roles. It's an interesting process for them, because we're playing two people who are very iconized in our the mythos of literature. You know, Shakespeare is iconized by like crazy, and so Michael Gertz, when I interviewed him about playing Shakespeare, he said, you know, the first thing I want to do is take everything I know about Shakespeare and throw it away.
Nice.
Because, you know, there's some expectation in it, and there's so much that can get you. Get in your own way if you're playing such an icon of character. And then Viola Dlessop, you know, this is a role that Gwyneth Paltrow won the Best Actress Award for at the Oscars. And for the longest time, that was the only person who played Viola Dlessop. And then when the play version came out, other actors had to step into the role. Just for a lot of theater people who love the movie, a very iconic role. And so, again, the first step is to take everything about Gwyneth Paltrow playing the role and throw it out the window. And how do I make this my own? And I feel like my actors have really, really done that. And it's beautiful to see how they work.
Excellent, excellent. So in addition to those two lead roles, what other characters are in the play?
Yeah, we got a lot of characters. So there's a lot of characters that are historical figures. Philip Henslow is in the play, who was the owner of the Rose Theater. That's played by Dave Knoll, who is just like the funniest, most spontaneous and out there guy I've ever met. There is the Lord Edmund Tilney, who was the Lord Chamberlain, who was in charge of censoring the theater, and that's played by Paul Gasciora. Queen Elizabeth I makes an appearance in the play, played by Michelle Sanner. Then there is John Webster, the playwright. He's in the play, played by Thomas Telly, as well as Kit Marlowe, the other leading playwright of the time, who was played by Michael Benson Harris in our production. So those are historical figures. And Richard Burbage, the lead actor of the Curtain Theater, as well as Ned Allen, the lead actor of the Rose Theater, they're both in this play, played by Tomas Fierro and Arup Chakrabarty, respectively. And those, you know, they're two of the greatest actors of London at the time, which, again, another huge challenge to portray. So those are a few of the historic characters, and there's also a bunch of fictionalized characters that have been created for the story. There's a moneylender who funds theater and sort of represents the everyman falling in love with theater, Hugh Fenneman, played by a fantastic local Shakespeare actor, Glenn Havlin, who's been seen on all stages across the area. He's a fantastic guy. There's Viola has a nurse who is the inspiration for the nurse for Romeo and Juliet, played by Kim Bromley, who's someone who's been in the theater scene forever, directed Chosen of Otto, and is such a, like, she's such, like, a lighthouse for live theater. Like, live theater in Marin would not be the same without her. And there's tons more. It's a 20-person cast, so it's a huge group, and there's actors playing 3 to 5 roles at a time, you know?
Wow. Like,
it's insane. It's chaotic. There's sword fighting. There's dancing. There's music. It's such a, you know, you come to this show, and you don't just get, I feel like there's this idea that, you know, I don't like Shakespeare because it's so textual, it's so heady, it's so cerebral, but this isn't that at all. First of all, this is humanizing Shakespeare, and two, I mean, this is fun. It's chaos. It's got sword fights. It's got people fist fighting each other backstage. It's got some musical numbers, which are really beautiful. And Jillian Eichenberger, the co-director of the play, and also our music director, she was in charge of directing the musical numbers, and they just sound beautiful from this wide variety of cast who have different voices and different vocal experiences. We have dance numbers done by Stephen Beecroft, the director of the Curtain Theater, who's also a fantastic classical dancer, and he's choreographed a few dance numbers for the piece. And then there's a lot of fighting done by me. My day job is I do stunt coordination, so that that I got to have fun putting these historic fights into the play. Yeah.
So your day job is you're a fight coordinator?
Yeah, I teach fight coordination at a couple high schools in the area.
That's awesome. So, so you're putting all of these fight scenes in. Is there a difference? I'm assuming there's a difference between teaching adults fight scenes for theater versus teaching high schoolers fight scenes.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. I think it's a fun difference. Like, there's one thing that with a lot of adults, you know, you can explain something very simply, and if they have a basic understanding of fight choreography language, you know, they just go right into it, mm-hmm. And it's super easy for them to pick up. You know, you've lived for a while, you're really comfortable in your body, and you're able to move around pretty comfortably with ease.
Mm-hmm.
For younger people, I think a lot of my job as a fight coordinator is to teach them and empower them to be comfortable in their bodies, to be okay with where they are physically, and then to make them feel, you know, cool and like they can hold their own in a stage fight, regardless of what physical type they are, you know. And so with younger people, that's a lot of the self-esteem building that takes place. Also with older people, a thing to take into consideration is mobility, you know.
Yes.
We have a couple people in our cast who have some mobility issues, mm-hmm. and we have a cast member who recently had a hand injury, and of course I'm doing stage combat, like a hand injury is something I have to take into account. So, you know, with actors from all different backgrounds, all different ages, all different experiences and mobility abilities, you know, that's something I gotta take really into consideration. And so I've been very, very careful with safety and with making these fights accessible for whoever is performing them, and playing to actors' strengths and making them feel confident with the combat. And I feel like Jillian's done that with the music, and Steve's done that with the dance as well.
So with all that being said, is there a particular fight move that is like either an audience crowd pleaser or an actor, like whenever you show it to them, they go, oh man, I'm so glad we're doing this?
Yeah, there are a few. The moment you tell an actor that they get to wield two swords, it's a really cool moment for them.
It's
really fun, and you get to play with that, the ballet of wielding two swords. We have this one moment in the show where our cast is, like I said, it's a diverse group of people. The youngest in our cast is 10, and the oldest is 70, which means we have over half a century of an age difference in our cast.
Uh-huh. And do they fight each other?
Well, the 10-year-old does have a fight. And she has this one moment where, you know, this guy thrusts the sword at her, and she moves out of the way, grabs his wrist and bites it, which I think is just so fun. And it's like totally, again, playing to the strength. I can't have her get in a fist fight with this, you know, 30-year-old man she's fighting with.
Right, right,
right. So, but a little kid can bite, and a little kid's bite can hurt.
Mm, yeah, they can. And they can kick and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. All right.
Moments like that, too, yeah.
So this is called, so when does it open? When does Shakespeare in Love open?
So the show opens at the end of this week, on Friday, May 19th. And there's a preview also on May 18th with discounted tickets. And then we run Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. This weekend, the next weekend, the weekend after, and the weekend after, 4 weekends in total, closing on June 11th.
And where can people get tickets?
Tickets are sold at NevadaTheaterCompany.org. Theater spelled E-R, not R-E.
Okay.
Or you can email tickets@NevadaTheaterCompany.org.
And where is Nevada Theater Company?
Nevada Theater Company is just off the 101 on 5420 Nave Drive, Novato. It's in a little strip mall. There's a dance shop and a jujitsu dojo on either side. But if you go down the street, there's actually some really nice, cute restaurants that you can go to before the show.
And if people want to find out more about the show or about what you're doing, how would they go about doing that?
Yes, of course. They can go to NevadaTheaterCompany.org, or they can follow Nevada Theater Company on Facebook or Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We post pretty much daily about updates on the show, who's in the cast. We post a lot of video content, so if you want to get a little sneak peek, if you're on the fence about seeing it and you want to see what's going on behind the scenes, check that out. We got a lot of fun content on there.
Well, Nick Moore, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out Shakespeare in Love at the Novato Theater Company. So go do it. You know you want to. You know you want to. And you know what? You gotta believe. You're listening to 89.5 FM, KPOO, San Francisco. That's the Pointer Sisters, and you got to believe from Yes We Can. Yeah, you do got to believe. You know what you can believe? You can believe that there's a lot of good theater happening We just got through talking with someone from the Novato Theater Company, and there's a theater called Little Books Theater that's playing a show called Tempting Fate. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome Ross Travis. Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Having me on.
Thank you for being on.
Good.
So before we get started about what you're actually doing, tell me, like, how long have you been doing theater?
I started doing theater when I was really young. I grew up in Colorado in a rural town there, and it had a summer camp called Perry Mansfield Performing Arts Camp, and it's pretty well known throughout the country, and so I was very fortunate to grow up there and study with some really amazing people, and it's actually the claim to fame of the camp is that Dustin Hoffman went there when he was a kid. So, yeah, I was in that lineage of being there, the place he had been. So, yeah.
So was this something that you always wanted to do, or was it something that they put you in and you took to it immediately?
I was always very shy as a kid, and doing theater was a way for me to, you know, expose and live out my inner self in a way that was fun for me in front of other people, because in my life I was shy, and I also loved playing characters, and from a young age I was always wearing weird hats and, like, taking on other personas. That was a way for me to express myself, I guess. Yeah.
So you say you were shy growing up. So does that mean that when your family would see you on stage, it'd be like, wow, he's never like this. He's normally so quiet and reserved.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And also with the forms of theater that I ended up going into, such as clowning and circus, and the particular form of theater that I do in this show is called Buffon, and it's very interactive with the audience and very present with the audience. So, you know, I think it has been, because in my normal day-to-day life, I'm maybe a little reserved and, like, I'm not, like, really forward, but these forms of theater are, like, very much so and very, you know, in your face, I guess. Yeah.
So let's talk about this show, Tempting Fate, and you say you do a style called Buffon. So is that, like, buffoon, or is it something different?
Yeah, the Buffon is, like, the hoity-toity French pronunciation of buffoon.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so, and the form was codified in the 60s and 70s by a physical theater luminary named Jacques Lecoq in Paris, France.
Okay.
And he took all of these satirical traditions throughout history. For example, the Feast of Fools celebration during the medieval times, where all the hunchbacks and the lepers and the people who had been ostracized from the society would come down into the town square, and they would be given permission for a day to wear the king's crown and, you know, point and mock and show from their vantage point what this society looked like. And this gave the royalty and those people a way to see their hypocrisies and see the way in which their society wasn't living truthfully or in, like, power, you know? And so he took from that tradition. And the satyr plays from the Greek times, where, you know, there would be a production of Oedipus Rex, and then afterwards these people with goat feet and, like, goat costumes would come on and mock the tragedy that had just happened. He also looked at indigenous shamans throughout history and throughout the world, and you know, their place within indigenous cultures, how they hold a place of reverence and keep the society grounded through speaking truth to the power within the society. So Jacques Lecoq pulled from all these traditions and made this form of theater, and so that's like the basis of what I do. And we can see this form of theater in popular culture now with mm-hmm. people like Sacha Baron Cohen and Steve Colbert and folks like that.
Wow. So this the person that you were referencing just sounds fascinating. So you've touched my mind. It makes me want to go out and learn more about this person. So tell me about this show, Tempting Fate.
Yeah. So Tempting Fate is a satirical sideshow about the climate crisis that we're currently in. And I play 30 different characters within the show. And in the form of Buffon, one of the aspects of it is this ability for these creatures who come from, you know, the outskirts of society to come in and be able to basically shapeshift.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very mercurial. So I have like a base character, but then that character switches into all these other entities, and all of those entities are around this theme of what's going on with the climate crisis. And so within Buffon, it is grotesque satire, and mm-hmm. it's like the base root of satire dwells in the gray area of issues. So in our increasingly polarized society right now, it's very like issues become very black and white.
Yeah.
And this form of theater really tries to be spiral in on how we're all complicit in things and in which ways. So it can be you know, nobody's safe, but everybody's having a great time. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that through this powerful mix of comedy and tragedy, laughter and sadness, we can walk away from a Buffon performance with hopefully some kind of cathartic new realizations about the issue that it's talking about.
So is it a one-man show?
Yeah, it's a one-man show, and I play 30 characters, and you know, my aesthetic sense is for a very maximalist vision. So some Buffon shows, you'll have one person playing all these entities, but they won't change costumes. But I have a harpy character, for example, with this really huge mask and these big 8-foot wings and these claws, and so I'm that character at one point, and then you know, a couple scenes later I'm this liberal cheerleader, so I'm like in this like, you know, blonde wig and this cheerleader outfit, and then I'm like a conservative like conspiracy theorist at one point. And so there's all of these different archetypes that I'm you know, delving into and playing in the show.
That sounds like quite an undertaking. How long have you been working on this show?
So I started working on it in 2018, 2019, and I premiered it here at Little Boxes Theater in 2019. I got some grant support through San Francisco Arts Commission and, you know, some donors and stuff mm-hmm. to make the show initially. And then I premiered it here. And then, of course, the pandemic happened mm-hmm. and I had hoped to tour it. And all those hopes got, of course, smashed.
Sure. Dashed against the rocks of reality.
Now, yeah, totally. So now I'm coming back to it, and it's been 4 years, which is so wild since I last did it, and I'm back here at this awesome theater here in this warehouse where all of this really interesting eclectic art happens.
Well, that's what I want to ask you
again.
I want to ask you about Little Boxes Theater,
because
I had never heard of it. And how long has it been there, and how did you find out about it?
Yeah, they've been here for quite a few years. I don't know exactly, but it's on 1661 Tennessee Street. It's suite number 2. And they, it's like a multi-use theater. So they'll do photo shoots here. There's circus. There's theater. There's music. There's an opera company that works out here. And, yeah, so... in the way they have it set up, it's, like, really neat. Like, anything is possible in here. So you can come in and, for example, when I came in, it was just a white box, like, kind of set up for a photo shoot. And I came in and put blacks up against all the walls, and I changed the seating so it's, like, a French court, like, the audience is on either side. And then I have these big... paintings. I have one of a clown mouth, like a freak show clown mouth that the audience enters through. And then there's another kind of devil clown face that I do a lot of my entrances and exits through. So I've completely transformed the space, and it's a really neat theater here. So, yeah.
Well, so when does the play start?
So it's the 17th to the 21st at 8 p.m. nightly, and then we have an added performance on the 21st at 5 p.m. in the afternoon. So I'm doing two shows that day, which will be
interesting.
Quite an experience. Yeah.
And where could people find tickets?
They are at temptingfate.bpt.me on brown paper tickets. So you could just go on brown paper tickets too and just type in Tempting Fate and you would find us.
And give my listening audience the address of Little Boxes Theater.
It is 1661 Tennessee Street, and it's suite number 2. It's a warehouse, and there will be signage and stuff out front when folks come here.
And what's the cross street? What's the cross street?
It is Cesar Chavez.
Oh, okay.
Right at the end. Yeah, right at the end of Cesar Chavez, almost to the, you know, the industrial park there at the very end.
And if people if people want to find out more about what you're doing, how do they go about doing that?
I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I'm on TikTok. And it's all at Antic in a Drain. That's Antic in a Drain. It's like a clown in a sewer, kind of. So Antic in a Drain. Yeah.
And if people want to find out more about Little Boxes Theater?
Yeah, they would go to just look up Little Boxes Theater online. It's www.littleboxestheater.com, and that's theater spelled with an E-R, not an R-E.
That's the second one today. Oh, there's a trend.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, Ross Travis, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And I, you know, given how San Francisco feels about burlesque and bouffant and clown things, we've got that clown conservatory, I know that the show will be a great success.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for the work that you do there. Very important.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out Tempting Fate and check out this new, new to us, Little Boxes Theater. Oh, Mr. Ford's here. It's time for me to ride off into the sunset. He'll be pleasuring your ear hole. I'm going to be leaving you with a little something. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and tiddly-doo.
another day go back.